Chapter 13, The Ancient Problem of Debt. Think about it. If you've ever been in serious debt, you know the feeling, the sleepless nights, the knot in your stomach when the bill arrives, the way debt colors every decision and relationship. The ancient world understood this intimately. People could be forced into slavery, families could be destroyed by unpayable obligations, and communities could be torn apart by the tension between creditors and debtors. The suspicion of interest wasn't simply anti-business. It reflected a recognition that some things were more important than financial returns, social stability, community, and the ability of people to rebuild their lives. The archaeology of debt. Much of what we know about ancient debt comes from the clay tablets of Mesopotamia. Thousands have been excavated, documenting loans, contracts, and legal disputes. Together, they provide a remarkably detailed picture of how debt functioned in the earliest civilizations. A typical loan was straightforward. A farmer might borrow grain or silver from a temple or wealthy merchant. The amount, interest rate, repayment date, and collateral were recorded on a clay tablet. Both parties affixed their seals, and the tablet was stored as a legal record. Interest rates were high by modern standards, typically around 20% for silver and 33% for grain. These rates reflected both risk and the seasonal nature of agricultural production. Grain borrowed before the harvest had to be repaid after it, so interest compensated the lender for the possibility of a failed harvest. But these loans were more than financial transactions. The creditor was often a member of the same community, a neighbor, merchant, or relative. Debt was embedded in a social relationship. The debtor was expected to repay, but the creditor was also expected to recognize circumstances beyond the debtor's control. A failed harvest could lead to an extension or forgiveness of the loan. The objective was not simply to enforce repayment at any cost, because destroying the debtor could also damage the community. This was an important form of economic wisdom. A creditor's long-term interest depended on the continued health of the community. The Jubilee. Perhaps the clearest expression of the ancient concern about accumulating debt was the Jubilee. In ancient Israel, the Jubilee was described as a periodic reset involving the release of debts, the freeing of slaves, and the restoration of land. Its underlying principle was radical. Debt should not be allowed to accumulate indefinitely until it destroys the social order. You might reasonably ask, why would anyone lend if the debt could eventually be cancelled? Because the Jubilee was not simply charity. It was a structural response to the tendency of debt to accumulate and concentrate wealth and power. Similar practices existed elsewhere. Mesopotamian rulers periodically issued decrees canceling debts and restoring economic equilibrium. Ancient Egyptian rulers sometimes remitted debts and taxes. In Athens, Solon's Syzactheia, or shaking off of burdens, addressed severe debt problems. These practices were different in detail, but they responded to the same underlying problem. Debt can accumulate faster than the society supporting it can sustain. The ancient world understood something we sometimes forget. Debt is a human institution, not a force of nature. It can be created, modified, forgiven, regulated, or redesigned. The Jubilee did not reject lending. It recognized its limits. Debt could finance productive activity, but it could not be allowed to become a permanent mechanism of social destruction. The moral economy. The ancient suspicion of interest was rooted in what we might call a moral economy, the idea that economic relationships are embedded in social relationships. The purpose of the economy was not simply accumulation. It was to sustain the community. Stability mattered. Sufficiency mattered. Justice mattered. This perspective can seem foreign to a modern economy that often treats economic relationships as technical transactions governed by prices and contracts. But the older view recognized something fundamental. Economic institutions reflect human values. The transition from the ancient moral economy to the modern financial system was not simply a progression from ignorance to knowledge. It was a transformation in values and institutions. Debt gradually became less of a social relationship and more of a financial claim. Interest became a price rather than a moral concern. Periodic debt cancellation came to be viewed as interference with the market rather than a mechanism for maintaining stability. That transformation was not inevitable. It resulted from centuries of changing institutions, ideas, technologies, and economic conditions. And if financial institutions were created through human choices, they can be redesigned through human choices. The invention of money. Understanding ancient debt also requires understanding the origins of money. One influential interpretation is that early money was closely connected to credit and debt. Clay tablets recorded claims on future grain or silver, and transferable claims could function as a medium of exchange. The important insight is that money is not merely an object. It is also a social claim. A monetary claim represents an expectation that something of value can be received in the future. That makes trust fundamental. If people lose confidence that claims will be honored, the monetary system itself becomes unstable. Ancient societies understood the connection between credit, trust, and community. If claims accumulated beyond the community's capacity to honor them, the entire credit system could be threatened. Debt forgiveness, therefore, had a function beyond helping individual debtors. It could reset the relationships on which future lending depended. The Jubilee can be understood in this broader sense, not simply as forgiveness, but as a periodic restoration of economic and social capacity. The persistence of suspicion. The suspicion of interest did not disappear with the development of modern economics. It persisted in religious traditions, political movements, and financial crises. The Islamic prohibition of riba, for example, remains influential today and has contributed to the development of modern Islamic finance. The concept of usury also returned repeatedly in response to exploitative lending. Debt became an important issue in anti-colonial movements, and the global financial crisis demonstrated again how excessive leverage could destabilize entire economies. The persistence of this concern suggests that the ancient unease about debt was not simply primitive superstition. Debt creates a relationship between creditor and debtor. It gives the creditor a claim on the debtor's future income and assets. When those claims become excessive, the relationship can become a source of economic and political power. Ancient societies responded by developing mechanisms such as debt forgiveness, interest restrictions, and periodic resets. The modern financial system has different institutions and vastly greater complexity, but the underlying problem remains recognizable. Debt accumulates. Interest compounds. Claims grow. Eventually, the ability to honor those claims becomes the constraint. The lessons for today. The ancient experience offers several lessons. First, debt is a human institution. It was created for particular purposes and under particular conditions. It can therefore be redesigned for new circumstances. Second, debt has limits. When financial claims grow beyond the productive capacity of the underlying economy, instability follows. Third, periodic forgiveness can be a feature rather than a failure. The Jubilee recognized that a functioning credit system sometimes requires a reset. Fourth, the economy exists to serve society. Economic institutions are means, not ends. When they cease to support human flourishing, they should be reconsidered. Fifth, financial institutions are not neutral. Their design determines who receives returns, who carries risk, and who has power. Sixth, trust is fundamental to money and credit. Financial systems ultimately depend on confidence that promises will be honored. Excessive debt can undermine that confidence. These lessons remain relevant, even though today's financial system is vastly more sophisticated. The question is still the same. How do we manage debt so that finance serves the economy rather than the economy becoming trapped in the service of debt? The return of the Jubilee. There is a recurring modern movement to revive the idea of the Jubilee: debt forgiveness for developing countries, student debt relief, mortgage restructuring, and other forms of financial reset. such proposals are often dismissed as radical or irresponsible. But the underlying principle has deep historical roots. The Jubilee does not necessarily mean abolishing debt. It recognizes that debt has limits and that accumulated claims can eventually become destructive. But debt forgiveness alone cannot solve the underlying problem. It addresses the stock of accumulated debt without necessarily changing the mechanism that creates it. If the financial system continues to reward the accumulation of fixed claims and depends on perpetual economic expansion to sustain them, the same problem can eventually return. That is why the deeper solution requires institutional redesign. We need financial instruments that can adapt to economic conditions, rather than simply demanding fixed claims regardless of those conditions. We need mechanisms that align the interests of lenders and borrowers with the long-term productive capacity of the economy. This is where the productivity bond enters the story. It does not eliminate debt. It changes the relationship between debt and economic performance. By linking returns to productivity rather than simply to the passage of time, it attempts to make sovereign financing more compatible with the economy's actual capacity to generate value. The ancient world recognized that debt could not be allowed to grow without limits. The modern world has developed extraordinary financial technology, but the underlying problem has not disappeared. The question is no longer whether debt should exist. The question is what kind of debt should exist in the future. The ancient suspicion of interest was gradually replaced by the celebration of compound growth, a transformation that took centuries and was driven by intellectual, institutional, and technological change. The next transformation may require us to ask a different question. What if finance rewarded productive progress, rather than assuming perpetual growth?